Well, this morning, we've called this morning Vision Sunday because God has been preparing something in me to share, something that will continue to develop and evolve. This is not something that is just, let's do this in 30 minutes and then we'll lock it away and forget about it. It's not like that at all. This is a living, breathing journey that we go on, and we go on it together. So I want to talk about that this morning. I've got some stuff I want to share with you and show you, and we want to work out how on earth we can make sure we keep on the path. The question I've got for you right at the start is, how many of you like ice cream? We're coming into summer. Come on, Kiwis consume 60 million litres of ice cream each summer. So I know I don't do all of that on my own. There must be some of you that help out, surely. But ice cream. I love ice cream. And when I was a child, growing up, I don't know if I've told some of you the story before, but growing up as a child, of course, I loved ice cream. Mum would make her mum's world-famous chocolate sauce that would be in a preserving jar in the fridge, and we would look forward to having that of an evening. But ice cream was also a tool that my mum used to help me with my behaviour. And I know that none of you would do this with your children. But my mother was a frenetic seamstress, a sewer. She loved to sew. And there was always the whir of the sewing machine or the overlocker going on in the back bedroom where she had her stuff set up. And we would watch this as a child, and we would enjoy the fruit of her labor as children. And in those days, I was very, very proud to march off to school wearing brown corduroys that my mother had made and a brown skivvy that matched. It wasn't until I was a little bit later I realized it wasn't very cool. But Mum loved to sew clothes, and she loved to sew things, and she just enjoyed the creativity in it. And we lived in Lower Hutt at the time, and so Mum would pack us into her XY Falcon and drive down the hill, and she would park in Lower Hutt, and we would go into a drapery store called Carey's. Carey's Drapery. It was one of those old school stores that was, you know, inch thick dust all the way around it, and there was fabric for miles, and my mother would take us to the back of the store. And there would be on the counters, much like this but much longer, there would be these massive books of patterns. Does anyone know what I'm talking about? And she would stand there for days, and she would turn the pages, and she would be looking for inspiration and what she might make as her next project. And I don't think my brother was around at the time, but my sister and I were both preschool, and we'd be crawling around in the dust and doing what kids do. And so my mum, to help us to behave well, she would say, "Look, when I'm finished, we'll duck around the corner and we'll grab some ice cream." And I was like, "Ice cream." She says, "Now, you be good now. You're good. We'll be scurrying around the corner. We'll be getting some ice cream." I'm like, "Yes, Mum. Ice cream." I would say to my sister, "We're getting ice cream. We're getting ice cream. It's going to be good. We're going to have ice cream. Wonder what kind of ice cream we're going to get." And we'd lie there on the floor in the dust, and we'd just imagine ice cream. And then Mum would find the thing she wanted, and I'm like, "Yes, ice cream." And then she would walk over to these big filing cabinet drawers, big metal things, and she'd pull out the drawer, and she'd fussick through the packets of the patterns. You guys know, some people as old as me know what they're talking about. And she'd fussick through, and she'd pull it out. She'd like, "It's a trophy." And when she got the trophy, I knew that I would soon get my reward. And so sure enough, if I was well behaved, which of course I was, my sister and I would hold hands, and we'd go around the corner, and we'd get ice cream. Ice cream is always good, always. And I think the honest truth is, when I'm in that store, there's only one thing I'm thinking about, isn't there? What is it? Ice cream, that's right. And the thought of a reward, the thought of something good, the thought of a promise being made good was something that I kept my attention on. I fixed my attention. My mum knew this, because if I fix my attention on the ice cream, I don't fix it on bruising my sister or pulling down things off the shelves. And one of the things that I find remarkable amongst church is not the fact that some of you don't like ice cream. Like, it's okay, I get that. Maybe lactose intolerance or whatever, gluten, I don't know. But anyway, but what I find remarkable amongst church people, people that read the story and know the end and the author personally, is that I reckon some of us have forgotten that God's promised us ice cream. You read the book, understand the author, because you know him personally, it's good news. God's promised us ice cream. This book is full of promises. And to me, that's the essence of a vision that God gives us. It's a promise of something we don't have yet, but it's something that we will get soon. And promises like this, visions like this, they're conditional. They're about participation and partnership and walking. And some of us drop promises from time to time. And yet God is so good and so loving and understanding that he allows us to, even if we trip, even if we make a mistake, even if we pull all that stuff off the shelf and make a mess in the middle of the store, he's still like, okay, well, you tidy up your mess and then I'm going to give you some ice cream. Because that's the nature of a good father. And I start with that because I want to talk about the future today. I want to paint a picture for the future. And I want to say God is in it. This is not a, hey, here's what Phil thinks we should do. This is the result of me getting before God and wrestling to put aside anything that I might consider a good idea to make sure I hear very, very clearly what he would say for us. This is very much a, here's what I believe, I have a strong conviction that this is what God says for North End Church. And so whether we've had disappointment in the past or whether we've dropped a promise or pulled stuff off the shelf or whether we think we've made mistakes, God would say to us at the beginning, his promises are good. And his promises are for his family to walk forward into. No matter what our situation is, the vision should stir us with hope. We've been asking God this week to release hope as a response to the vision that we cast, because hope will draw us through the mess. Hope will draw us out of a hole. Hope will lift us up and equip us and give us energy to move forward. Hope that comes from God. Today's about the future pathway for North End Church. I'm even going to be bold enough to describe what the church might look like in 2030. Am I absolutely certain we're going to get there? Well, I really don't know. Because I'm not the one in charge of that. But I'm willing to put a stake in the ground and have a look at it. Am I certain this is what God's inviting us into? Yes, I am. And to start this morning, what I want to do is I want to share something that God said to me in January this year. And I want to explain it to you because prophecy builds a platform for a revelation of vision. Prophecy is when God speaks. And those with a prophetic ear will hear God speak and they'll recognize it as the prophetic voice of God, and it's tested and it's measured and it's weighed and it's confirmed as a word of God. That's what I'm about to read to you. But here's why that's important. Prophecy builds a platform for a revelation of vision. Vision flows out of what God has already said, interestingly enough, which makes it nothing new. In January, the Lord gave me this word for the church. I want to read it to you. Revival, God says, begins with family. Revival begins in family. Revival is coming in our family, meaning our church. Revival will come as we build our family. Revival will flow from family. Revival is for us to enjoy, and revival is for us to share. Revival for our town is God's ultimate purpose. Revival begins with family. As I shared that with the elders earlier in the year, they were somewhat excited, but somewhat, they wanted to check it, as they should do. And they said to Phil, what does revival mean? Because some people, revival means swinging off the chandeliers and taking your clothes off. For some people, they think that means that church is just chaos and there's no structure and no order. For some people, they think revival is where we might have tent meetings outside for 270 days in order to see the whole of town come to salvation. And revival does look like that. Tamara's booked that in already. There are churches that literally have seen revival when they do that. We've seen an outbreak of revival in some ways with healings that have been happening in church and restoration as people submit themselves to him. But in response to the question of the elders, I went doing some research, and in one of the books that I read, a book called Revival Culture, you hit the title, you think, well, he's bound to have something in there, and it's a book called Revival Culture by Michael Brodeur, who's based in San Francisco now, saved out of the hippie movement. His parents helped him to appreciate the effects of marijuana at 13, and by 16 he was on LSD with his parents, because that was what families did in the hippie movement. But he's out of that now, thankfully, you'd hope, because I'm about to quote him. So Michael says this, let me share it with you as a definition of revival. Revival is the spiritual resurrection of a person, a congregation, a region, or a nation. that has lost its first love and grown cold to the passion and purpose that blazes in the heart of God. Revival is the rebirth of consecration and devotion in the lives of those who've grown complacent or have been compromised by a lifestyle that's become encumbered by the cares of the world. Revival is the restoration of the power of God to the people of God. Revival is the recovery of the great purpose of God, that his kingdom would come and his will be done on earth in Te Ao Muru as it is in heaven. Yeah, that's where we're heading. That's what God says. And so that prophetic word that I hold to builds a platform for a revelation of vision. It's really important that we understand that God speaks first and we follow after that. Let's have a look at a group of friends that we have in the Bible. If you turn to Exodus chapter 3, we have a situation at the beginning of Exodus where the people of God are in captivity in Egypt. And it's part of God's plan. He kind of knows what's happening. It's all been good. But there's been many, many years, 400 years of slavery and oppression. And it's getting worse. They get beaten with sticks. And suddenly we find in Exodus 3, God says it's time to do something about it. It's time to move on. So in verse 7 of Exodus 3, there's this burning bush encounter. So Moses comes before the burning bush, which signifies the presence of the Lord God Almighty. And in verse 7, the Lord says to Moses, "I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt. I've heard their cries of distress because of their harsh slave drivers. Yes, I am aware of their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and lead them out of Egypt into their own fertile and spacious land. It is a land flowing with milk and honey." That means it's good, very good. "And a land where the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites now live. But look, the cry of Israel has reached me, and I have seen how harshly the Egyptians abuse them. Now go, for I am sending you to Pharaoh. You must lead my people out of Egypt." God comes and he chooses this guy that's not qualified, who doesn't really know what he's up for, but God says, "Will you go and will you be my man who leads people into my promise?" Moses has a little bit of a hiccup on that, but we're not going to look at Moses today. But my point is this: God comes and he declares a promise for God's people, his people. He says, "It's a land that's good. I'm going to take you to a place where you have freedom. I'm going to take you to a place where you live in my abundance. I'm going to take you to a place where you push out the enemies, where you have victory over them, and you are blessed by flowing milk and flowing honey and lots of abundant crops." That was good news for them. Again, after the people have traveled for 40 years, there's a hiccup in the middle there, but we get to the book of Deuteronomy. And Deuteronomy is the story where Moses just recaps the journey before they step into the fulfillment of the promise. In Deuteronomy 6, verse 10, Moses is saying to the people, "Remember, the Lord your God will soon bring you into the land he swore to give you when he made a vow to your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So the promise goes back much, much further. "It is a land with large, prosperous cities that you did not build. The houses will be richly stocked with goods you did not produce. You will draw water from cisterns you did not dig, and you will eat from vineyards and olive trees you did not plant. When you've eaten your fill of the land, be careful not to forget the Lord who rescued you from your slavery." Again, he's reminding them that God is leading them to a place where he has made provision for them to step into. Now, in between that, it was 40 years of journey. We might talk a little bit about that. So let's talk about them, but before we do that, let's talk about us. What is the vision, what is the mission that we're facing? Pastor Nick, who some of you know, one of my, I suppose you call him a spiritual dad, really. He's been an elder of this church and led us through a transition season for some time now. He sat with me one day, and as we do, in a cafe in Cambridge where he lives, and he had tea and I had coffee, and we had sweets because he likes sweets in the afternoon. And he says, "God, why did God call you and Kathy to Te Ao Muru?" And I sat back and I drank my coffee and I thought, the obvious answer is to lead a church. And Nick says, "Yeah, nah, it's bigger than that. Think about it. That's what you do and it's a part of it, but there's much, much more." He says, "Go away. Spend time with God. Ask God. Wrestle with what you hear until it becomes part of you. Then you'll know you've got the right answer." So I did. I spent months doing that. And God came and God clarified what I'm about to show you. The mission, the reason that God called me here for us, this is not me, this is us, is around activating community transformation. Essentially, this is thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. This is revival. This is the power of God being restored to the people of God. Activating community transformation isn't about a happy, clappy club where we hang out together and have fellowship and then we go home and forget about everyone else. It's about being a part of something that affects the community and transforms them in line with God's reality. That's what thy kingdom come is. This is an assignment, it's a mission, it's about going into the world and making disciples. We've just talked about that when we talked about missions. And we do that overseas, but we just as well better do it here as well. Activating community transformation, this is something we need to write on our hearts. It's something we need to get in our life stream, in our blood, so that it just comes, this is who we are, this is what we do. It's about everything we do. Whether you're at church, whether you're at work, whether you're at home, whether you're in the community, this is who we are and this is what we do. And what we're going to see today is we've all got a part to play in it. This has three parts to it. Church, social, and enterprise. And we'll talk about that in a minute. We're going to look at each one of these because essentially for us to say we have a mission and it just involves our life in church would be selfish. It's kind of like having all the ice cream in Te Awamutu and keeping it in here and only us eating it. That was never, ever God's intention. Most of you don't spend much time here each week. That's not a criticism. That's because you've got jobs and family and other things to do. Some of us are paid to spend time here, and we do it because God's asked us to, and we love it, mostly. We do. It's what gets us out of bed. It's what drives me in the morning. Right? But there's more than that. We've got a community. We've got a neighborhood. We've got friends. We've got to share what we've got, and that's why we need to have three parts to the mission. Let's look at church, because I've got a mission statement for each one of them. This is what church is. Church is all about making Jesus known. As a church family, we are called and empowered to make Jesus known through relationship and service. And by service, I don't mean a church service. I mean a demonstration of love to others. That's the mission of the church, North End Church, that we make Jesus known. We make it known by the way we live. We make it known by the way we make decisions. We make it known by the way we're generous and abundant with our generosity. We make Jesus known in all aspects of our lives. That's the purpose of church. Everything we do should serve that. Te Awamutu is not about just having a good old time with some Christmas lights. Last year we had over 400 people come through the doors of the building just to experience Christmas and be part of our family for half an hour, for an hour, for 2 hours. That's why we do community events. Because they're not here this morning. So we need to find another way to connect with them. Social. What do I mean by social? Social was about generating hope. Part of that's healing, but I changed it to generating hope. As a ministry, we're charged to generate hope by lifting people above their circumstances and elevating their vision for life. We've got to love people till they ask why. Now, what I find astounding in this as I come to Te Awamutu last year, is I discover that the fathers of this church, the forefathers, the people who started much longer ago than I can remember, is they already put this in place. You may not know this, many of you will, that we have a community trust already. It was established in 1993, founded by some visionary people who said, you know what, we need to get practical ways that we can help this town and love them and show them God's love. So they formed Rosetown Community Services Trust, started the counseling center. It's actually out the back here if you haven't seen it. 8 or 9 counselors helping people to find healing, restoring families that are broken, helping people out of the bondage of addiction. They have a child play therapy room over there. You've got to be careful if you go in there because it's heaps of fun and you might not come out. Why? Because they want to help children who have been hurt and broken because of life to have hope again. So I get in there and I understand what they do because I read the founding documents. And what I discover in the founding documents of the trust deed is that there are 18 objects of intent that they wrote down that they would like to see in Te Awamutu. Counseling is just one of them. So as trustees, we have now formed a strategy in order to begin multiple channels of service to our community, much, much wider than counseling. Loving Arms has agreed to move under there as a community outreach so they can have access to funding, so they can reach more people. It's a fantastic example of a way that we can love our town, and Shani and her team have been doing it for over almost 2 years now. Helping young mums to find hope because other people show them they love them. We're working on a youth project, and just this week I spoke with a guy called Billy Graham. You might have seen him on the TV. He's got a youth center in Nainai where they use boxing as a way to build champion men from the ages of 8. He said to me on the phone, boxing is just the way that I get to communicate with them. It's not about boxing. It's about growing champion men, changing their view of life so that they connect in a healthy way. He says, we're stopping some of our guys from being truants. We're stopping some of our guys from drugs. Why? Because we're meeting them where their needs are. So we're a bit serious about this. The trustees have just formed the strategy, and we're in the middle of recruiting a CEO to run the organization. Why? Because we've got a plan. We've got a strategy. We've got to develop multiple channels of service in order that our town would have needs met in a wider way. It's what the forefathers of the foundation set in place in the trust deed. And my responsibility is to honour that and open doors for it to happen. So I'm a bit serious about that. Enterprise. Well, the marketplace is something that makes a town tick. So the purpose of enterprise, as part of our mission, is to release purpose. Every single one of you has a purpose. Some of you are using that in the workplace. Some of you are using it in the home. Some of you are using it in the community. But every single one of you are participating in some kind of enterprise. And so what we want to do is we want to find ways to release purpose, because as kingdom citizens, we are challenged to release purpose by creating, sustaining, healthy, God-fearing enterprise. Why would we do that? Well, for one, it helps us to participate in the town, and when we participate in the town, we've got a right to participate in all that the town offers. We're not just a bystander, we're a participant. The other thing I love about enterprise is that it creates employment. But when you create employment and you have employees, it gives you the right to speak into the lives of your employees. So imagine having a group of people that we could disciple every day because we have them with us every day. We can communicate God's values to them. We can talk about God's work ethic. We can talk about the hope that is found in Jesus Christ. That's a really powerful opportunity if you hadn't thought about it. I mean, there are people in this room who have staff, the Christian business people in town who have staff that are ministering to their staff. That is a huge privilege. The other thing with enterprise is if it's healthy, there's cash flow that comes out of it. And I've got a few things I could do with that. Imagine if we could give $100,000 a year away to missions. Imagine that. You know, the schools and the orphanages that we're partnering with, the church planting that we're partnering with, what if we could treble the efforts that we're currently supporting overseas? What if some of that created opportunities for people in Te Awamutu or a school that could equip young people for their calling in life? Imagine what we could do. Enterprise. Now, we're going to need some help to do that. It's not just about me. Not just about me at all. These three things are about all of us. And what I'm doing is I'm casting it as a vision that we would all recognize that there is something there that we can do, a part we can play. And you might not know what it is today. By the end of today, you might not be quite connected with it, but I want you to pursue it. I want you to ask, God, in your quiet time, how can I be part of this? What do I do? How do I get there? Because we're going to need some help. And that means you, but we're going to need more people than we've got here, and that means we're going to need others. But what I know about vision is vision attracts energy. People are attracted to the opportunity to do something different and significant. Some of the people that we're interviewing for the CEO role in the Rosetown Community Services Trust, they're the ones that I want to find are the ones that are attracted to make a difference in a town, that can see social transformation as a calling, not just a job, that they can leave their fingerprints on this town and know that it's better when they're finished. Same for us. Church, social, enterprise. That's where we're going. The next part that's not so easy is the journey. Because it's all well and good to know that there's a destination, but as you'll see in the scriptures, knowing the destination and even arriving at the destination doesn't mean possession of the promise. And that's really what we need to talk about. But there's a journey. A revelation of vision is always followed by a journey. That means we have to go from here to there. Here to there. That's what a journey looks like. And we're going to have a look at these people of God because they walked a while. But this slide here, this vision of revelation vision always followed by a journey, actually explains some of the bumps in the road that we're experiencing at the moment, some of the challenges people are facing. Because every time you put a vision out there, every time you try and reform and reshape culture, stuff crops up. It's called the journey. The purpose of that disruption is to try and take your eyes off the prize, eyes off the destination. We have to remain diligent, we have to remain focused, we have to remain committed. If you think about some of the upsetting stuff that's been happening lately, it's actually just a disruption. I want to talk about what that looks like. But here's a pathway. I promised you that I would describe the church, if I could, in loose terms, in 2030. Any vision, any good vision, any strategy attached to vision has milestone markers so that you know what the progress is that you're walking towards. Because some of you are thinking 2030, I mean, am I even going to have my own teeth by then? I'm not sure, but you know, we did some math the other night and we worked out how old we're going to be in 2030 and some of us weren't prepared to tell the answer. We've got to have milestone markers so we know what the seasons are and the steps are along the journey. 2018 is the closest one. And what I'm believing by then is that we're going to have an internal belief that we can actually do this. Some of you are looking at it going, well, okay, we'll just see how that works out for them. First and foremost, we need to focus on our own strength. God said to me when I came here, Phil, your first assignment is to gather and build family. I was like, great, what do I do after that? God says, no, you haven't finished that. Keep going. That was last Christmas. I'm getting to this Christmas. I'm going, great, what do I do next? And he's like, gather and build family. Because it's so important that we get a revelation of kingdom family. It's so vital that we understand what it means to be healthy, strong, connected, united in one strength in order to move forward. And we're doing great. I mean, the times we have as a family and the fellowship and the unity in some ways is outstanding and inspiring for me. But it's still not the fullness of what God would have us to participate in for where we're going. But more than that, for this purpose of this message, it's about an internal belief that we can actually accomplish the mission God's given us. And you've got to do that from a place of being healthy. Because when you're feeling weak, downtrodden, or just a little bit bruised, you might look and go, oh, I don't have the strength for that. Well, I want you to say, you know what? I have got the strength for that. An internal belief. So I've been having chats with the Lord about this and a lot of prayer going into this behind scenes. And next year, well, there's one theme and one theme only. And that theme is belonging. The theme for 2017, everything we're going to talk about next year points towards belonging. Belonging here. Our people, our tribe, our purpose, our mission. That's the theme for next year. That we would grow people who are healthy. We would grow people who are strong. We'd come together with united strength so that we can make a positive impact on our town. We must pray, thy kingdom come, and we must believe it can happen. 2020, for me, is described as critical mass. We've got to be of a size that in our town that we can make a difference. Now, I'm not looking just for bums on seats. Would I like the church to be bigger and stronger? Yes, I would. But here's why. Critical mass is something that happens at a certain tipping point, you get to change and influence society. Let me give you an example that's not so positive, but I'll give it to you. Many years ago in California, there was a move in order to bring about the legalization of gay marriage. And when they worked it out, they realized they only had 3% support. Which means 97% of people weren't willing to vote for the legalization of gay marriage. But do you know what 3% did? They changed the law and they changed the culture of the state of California. Now, not positive, but it's an example that you don't need the majority to change society. We don't have to have 50% of our town sitting in our church, being part of our family, but what we do need is a critical mass. We need enough of us who believe that it's God's calling for us to move forward and we're willing to put everything into it and we give ourselves to it so that we can reach the tipping point of critical mass where we actually begin to change the culture of our town. Is that possible? Absolutely. You don't need a majority. You just need the numbers that will grow in conviction to believe it to be true. Now, when that starts happening, we start gaining influence in our town. So 2025 is about being in a position of influence. What does that mean? I've described it this way. I believe by 2025 there will be people and kingdom-minded, spirit-filled Christians that will be invited to the table of local government to help make decisions. Think Joseph. Think Daniel. I've got friends that live overseas that have been invited into the mayor's office to pray regularly because the mayor now recognizes that prayer makes a difference to his town. I read stories in the kind of books that I read where the town people are willing to believe that if they pray and they petition God, that crime will stop in their town and the prison will close. And there is evidence that that has happened in some places in South America. You can have an influence and change society when you partner with God in the vision and the mission that he's given us. Influence means that we're recognized. Let me read to you a post from Chris Vallotton yesterday. Chris is a pastor in the States. He says this on his blog site. It's time for the body of Christ to carry the kingdom into the darkest places of society. He's giving us new eyes to see through the darkness, through the cloudiness and fogginess, so that we can see the gold in people clearly. Precious souls wrapped up in sin are just waiting to be recovered and set free. This is how we will see cultures transformed by the kingdom, by going into dark places and bringing the wisdom we carry as believers. It's not just about meeting on Sunday morning. It can't just be about meeting on Sunday morning. It's about being prepared to go. And finally, 2030 is about transformation. If we're going to be activating community transformation, it really needs to be our target. Transformation is when the public recognizes and acknowledges that kingdom culture sustains community. When they actually recognize that what we're doing is helping shape our town in a positive way. That's why I love being a participant in the Christian school locally. Not because about Christian education, that's great, but what we're actually doing there is changing, shaping the lives of young people who will be tomorrow's leaders. Building them as committed disciples of Jesus Christ in order that when they leave school, they're actually going to make a difference wherever they land. That's the purpose of Christian education. It's the purpose of discipleship, transformation, kingdom culture sustaining our community. And if not overseas, why not here in Te Awamutu? Why not? Why not? So a revelation of a vision is always followed by a journey. Revelation of a vision is always followed by a journey. So there's a couple of things I want to look at as I've described where we're going. What I will do is I will prepare some of the stuff for you to have as a takeaway. I didn't have time to do it this week. It'll definitely be on the website, but I'll have them as something that you can look at and read through and pray through. But the problem with the journey is it gives opportunity to fall over. Anyone that doesn't reach the destination has failed because of disappointment, or they get taken out, or they get distracted. And knowing that that's the case, when people do that, is my job to therefore highlight why. So I want to introduce you to a concept that I learned from a mentor of mine. It's called the tunnel of transition. Tunnel of transition was shared with me by a friend of mine and a mentor in the States called Dr. Lance Wolnow, and he says this: the tunnel is when the journey feels like hell, but you know God's in it. Meaning it's not comfortable. Meaning it's squeezing you. We can see this in Numbers chapter 13. People of Israel know there's a promise, a land flowing with milk and honey, and they actually arrive at the border. In Numbers 13, Moses sends 12 scouts into the land. They're 40 days traveling through, picking grapes the size of basketballs, seeing the towns that are fortified and strong and a beautiful place to live. And they're like, that's exactly the way God described it. But when they come back, 10 of them say to Moses, no, 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 we cannot go in. Oh, no, 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 look, the people are like giants. And their cities are so beautiful and strong, we could never occupy them. So the tunnel of transition, whilst you might think it is a straight and easy path, it's more like this. It's squeezed, it's narrow, it's full of distractions, it's things that are going to trip us up. And I call these today, oops, I call these, if we just look at these, I call these vision blockers. These things that push and squeeze and challenge us in the tunnel of transition are vision blockers. And they're obvious as obvious, but most people don't take time to notice what's coming against them, so they feel, oh my goodness, I'm feeling bad. Oh my goodness, this is hard work. Oh my goodness, why do these people keep going like this? And they don't realize that there's outside forces pressing and pushing in the journey that's affecting them. And they're not recognizing it for what they are. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to call it out for what it is. And if you're feeling downtrodden, if you're feeling tired, if you're feeling just disconnected, maybe the problem's not you. You're experiencing it, but maybe it's something else that's coming over you that's affecting you to stop you from the journey towards the vision and the connection with your purpose that God's got for you. Where do we find the vision blockers? Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. Moses talking to the people. He says this: when the Lord your God brings you into the land you're about to enter and occupy, he will clear away many nations ahead of you. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. These seven nations are greater and more numerous than you. When the Lord your God hands these nations over to you and you conquer them, you must completely destroy them. Make no treaties with them and show them no mercy. So can you see those vision blockers there? They're in the text. The seven nations that must be overcome in order for us to fully possess the land. You see, there's a difference between arriving at the destination as they had done and possessing it, living in it, and receiving the fruitful abundance from it. There's a difference. To occupy and possess, you must overcome and fully destroy the enemy, as highlighted in this text. Here are the vision blockers that we read in the text. The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. These are seven nations that must be overcome, and each one of them has a significance in our lives. We've got to completely destroy them. They appear in our lives all the time, but if we don't notice them for what they are, then they can take us out, they can trip us up, they can knock us over, or they can just bind us so that we never actually reach the promised land. So let's call it out for what it is. The Hittites were a nation that were known for terrorizing people. They were aggressive, and their name actually means terror. What does that look like in your life? That means fear and confusion and discouragement wrapping itself around you and stopping you from moving. We can help with that. But the other thing that I want to make very, very clear to us is it's not just about us. Think of all those young ones that are running around out there and outside now playing games. If we allow ourselves to be bound by fear, confusion, or discouragement, we're literally binding their potential because we're teaching them how to do life as a disciple. This is much bigger than just us sorting our stuff out. But think about the impact on our families in the future. So why would we destroy the Hittites? Not just for our sake, for the sake of our children and their children, for the sake of our town. We've got to drive fear out. We've got to drive confusion out. We've got to just drive discouragement out of our world so that it has no hold on those who follow after us. Praise God, he's got the victory for us. Who's next? The Girgashites. These guys lived in mud huts. They dwell. Their name means to dwell in soil. Now, what this represents in our life is the old nature. Adam, who came from the soil, was the first man. He's represented biblically as the flesh, the old man, the old self. What does that look like? It means relying on your strength and the way that you've done things. If you're guilty of saying things like, well, this is the way I am and this is the way I've always been, guess what you're doing? You're empowering the Girgashites to bind you and limit your potential. And if you say it to your kids, you're binding them and limiting them as well. This is not a telling off. This is me pointing things out, calling them what they are, so that you can see them conquered and destroyed in your family and in this family for the church's sake. The Amorites lived on the hill. They're called the High Ones. That's what their name means. The Amorites, if you read the story of Israel going across into the land of the Amorites, they had to attack them up on the hill. What does this represent in the human nature of us on our journey? It means being boastful and prideful. taught in School of the Spirit recently that one of the limiting factors for us to move into the new season of life, I said to them, don't just hold on to failures in the past. You've just got to make sure you also don't hold on to the successes of the past. Either one of those is going to take you out. Stand fresh in a revelation of today that God's got for you. Does that mean we don't celebrate? No, it doesn't mean that. But what it means is you can't say, well, this is me, I've reached it, now I'm awesome. We've got to get rid of the Amorites in our life. The Canaanites. Canaan was the son of, I think it was Ham. It was definitely one of Noah's sons. He's a descendant, but he's the guy who undressed Noah and left him naked and caused Noah to be filled with shame. The Canaanites were a people who became domineering. They wanted to oppress others. They were driven by greed and lust. They had no honor for hierarchy. They had no honor for other kings. They marched in and took what they wanted because they were the Canaanites. I know one of the things that I need to be careful of is that I am driven by personality. By nature, I want to see things happen. And sometimes I'm like a bulldozer. I apologize for that. Because I'm not very gentle sometimes in how I do things. Sorry, honey. But I know that's a risk of mine. So I don't rest on my laurels, but I certainly don't make sure that it's not greed or lust for other things or dishonor that drives me. Because the Lord does not honor those things. And I will trip myself up, I will fall flat on my face, and blood will pour out of my nose, and then I'll say, oh, that's right. That's not how God wants me to live. And I have to destroy the Canaanites, the flesh that's part of me. The Perizzites. They lived just happy in tents. They didn't have a city. They didn't have any walls. There was no protection. They were what was called unwalled. They didn't care. It's like, hey, whatever. And what that represents in our lives is apathy, an absence of commitment to something. And I'm going to be honest with you. It's a biggie for this family. We're all tired. We're all busy. We've got lots on. There's stuff I want to do. But when you live like that, you are ripe for attack. We're going to look at the positive side of these in a minute because we want to break the power of them. The Hittites means life. That's the name. The name means life. But these guys just take life as it is. They go, yeah, whatever, we're going to do it. They're impulsive. But in being impulsive, they're often deceitful to get where they want to go. So I'm going to just tell a half-truth in order to make things happen the way I want to make them happen. Or I'm not going to think clearly through the consequences of what I'm going to do, so if I make a mistake, I'll just cover it up. Be sure those things will be uncovered. Because anything that's kept in the dark has power over you. The only way for things to be broken completely is to bring things into the light, where shame, sin, and bondage has no power in the light. That's what the Hivites mean. Finally, Jebusites, their name means to trample down. And there are some, as I indicated before, like a bulldozer who will trample others. But often it's done in immorality. It's done illegally, or it's done by hurting other people. It's like blatant immoral behavior. So the reason I highlight these is essentially to call them for what they are. They're in the scriptures as the obvious enemies of the people of God to stop the people of God from obtaining the promise. It would be like my mum saying to me, if I could comprehend it as a four-year-old, my mum getting down on the floor and saying, son, I promise you an ice cream. I'm just going to do this, and you're going to get an ice cream. But watch out for these seven things that might stop you getting ice cream. Now, as a four-year-old, I'm just not going to understand. But God, in his wisdom, as our Father who leads us, has given us clearly what the enemies are that would rob us from the future promise he's already declared for us. And our response has got to be, well, do we leave them as they are, or do we completely destroy them? I want you to read the text in Deuteronomy 7, verse 2. Listen carefully. When the Lord your God hands these nations over to you and you destroy them. He's making it as easy as he can. We talked about this when we talked about prayer last week. Victory through prayer means that prayer wins battles, not muscles. God goes before us and declares victory for us to step into and to apprehend. I'm not saying it's hard work for you. I'm saying God's done the hard part. You've just got to step into the victory he's already made available to you. That was supposed to be exciting. The answers to our questions are all based on biblical truth. I'm not going to go through them now, but this would be very, very good for you to perhaps take note of. If you want to overcome fear and confusion, find fear of the Lord. Get a revelation of his love so that it absolutely smashes you in a positive way and transforms you. If you want to overcome the old person, then get a revelation of your baptism into Jesus Christ, because that's the way Paul describes it in the New Testament. You are a new creation, no longer subject to the pulls of the old creation. If you've got trouble with gloating or being boastful, or you're actually just naturally successful, I love people like that, then what you want to do is you want to find a piece of humility. Humility is something God gives us by his grace. Find it in the text. Lust and dishonor can be overcome by purity of heart. Apathy is about getting a covenant commitment and connection. We're going to talk about that at the beginning of 2017 again. A covenant connection. We're bound together as family by the blood of Jesus Christ. That's what binds us in unity. We need to get a revelation of that. If you want to overcome impulsiveness and being deceitful, then understand that your integrity is in who you are in Christ. You don't have to be anyone you're not. You should be who God made you to be, and he's made you new, so stand tall in that. Get a revelation that you're a son of God or a daughter of God and stand confident in that. I don't have to compete or compare. You know what? Comparison is the enemy of our souls. Because when you stand there and say, well, I'm not as good or as tall or as talented as that person, guess what? The enemy's just planted lies in your heart that's going to rob you of your future. Stop comparing and be confident in your identity and who God made you to be. That's a blessing right there. Every single one of us are unique, and so we should be, because God made us that way. If you want to get over the exploitation of others or immorality, then we need to understand that our temple, our body is God's temple. It's a holy thing. We need to treat it that way. We need to honor it. We need to stop ruining it. Maybe ice cream's not that helpful. All things in moderation. Here, let me finish with this. The good news is, first and foremost, God's got the victory for you. He says it in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 2, I've done it. Now walk in it. That's good news, people. Take a sigh, a deep sigh, and go, pressure's off me. God's done it for me. But here's the other thing that I love. The possession of a vision always occurs through community. We're not to do it on our own. There's no need to do it on our own. We're called to walk together as a family. The people of God. I love the picture of this in Joshua chapter 1. So Moses, unfortunately, doesn't get to enter the promised land. Joshua's the next season. He calls the people together, rallies them together, and listen to what he does here. You've got to understand the promised land had a river down the middle of it, and so there's an east side of the river and a west side of the river. And on the eastern side of the river, God said through Moses, hey, look, you guys, you three, you can have this land. It's yours. Occupy it, and you can live here. It's good, abundant land for your crops. But then when you read in Joshua chapter 1, verse 12 to 17, Joshua gathers them together and he says, guys, look, I know you've got your promise. I know you're living in a place that's safe and abundant with good crops. But because you're part of the family, would you leave that for now? Cross the river with us and go into battle so that all the other tribes, the other nine tribes, can also occupy their promise. We're doing it together. It's not, well, you've got yours, sucks to be you. We see very, very clearly that we're to stand together and to walk in this together, each one getting their victory at the right time ordained by God. It was God who worked out and ordained which enemy would be overcome first. What I love about that when I work with people is I don't have to create opportunities for them to step into their healing. What I have to do is ask God, what's next? Is there anything today? And sometimes I see stuff that I don't think should hang around, and I ask God, and he says, no, they're not quite ready for that yet. I'm okay with that, because God, by his grace, will sustain them till the day of their freedom comes. You've got to understand, most of us are on a journey with multiple stages of freedom. Or is it just me? So the freedom is progressive. Maturity is progressive. The victory is progressive. But we're to do it in community. We're to do it together. We're to stand and fight our part of the battle for our brothers and our sisters, knowing that they will receive their promise and we'll celebrate with them. We've got somewhere to go and we've got something to do. Activating community transformation. I will prepare cards for you, I promise. I'm sorry I haven't done them today, but we will activate community transformation through church, through social, through enterprise. And in that, we will find a purpose for each one of us to be a part of God's picture, for his kingdom to come in Te Awamutu. But for us to step into that, we must overcome these vision blockers. What I want you to do is to stand for me. I'm going to close the meeting shortly. As Kathy said, today is that fourth Sunday where we purposefully have no fellowship because we want you to go and have fellowship with someone elsewhere. Take someone out for coffee, take them to lunch. If you don't want to take them to your house because you didn't clean up before you came to church, then what you should do is invite yourself to someone else's house. That's what I've done. Fellowship. Possession of the promise and the vision comes through community. So I'm going to create a space here for some of us to deal with some of this. Because the vision is exciting to me, but if we trip at the first corner, that's not so good. So as I've been speaking and I've been sharing, maybe some of you have seen that and gone, you know what, I reckon it's time to get rid of that. So I've got a song I'm going to play, if we can make sure the volumes are right for that. We're going to have a music that's going to play. It's one of my favorites at the moment, this song. Because the answer to finding freedom is to come to the altar of Jesus Christ. He has already done everything necessary for our freedom at every stage. The fullness of life comes when we surrender our life to Jesus. Some of us, we've been doing that for many years. Some, not so much. But when we come to Jesus and we say, Jesus, will you take my burden? Will you take my hurt? Will you take my issues? Would you take my limitations? Would you take them so I don't have them anymore? He does a beautiful exchange. He gives you beauty for ashes, joy for mourning. He gives you love in place of fear. He gives you freedom. He gives you hope. He gives you joy that you might step forward into the journey he's got for you. So as the song's playing, I invite you to come if you want. You want to just stand at the front. We're symbolizing the altar being the front of church today. And we'll make sure that if you want someone to pray with you, that you can have some prayer. But don't leave if you've got something to leave at the altar this morning. Jesus wants to take it all.